this morning. I've been running around doing double duty. Ralph's still in Florida, although he told me that he prayed and he caught his limit of red snapper a couple days ago. So he's still religious and he'll be back. And then Thomas is overseas. I want to say Ireland or Scotland. I get them mixed up, but which one? Both. Okay, I was right. And he's in a choir that's touring for, I think, about 9 or 11 days. And then Sarah Aiken is gone with her husband for, I think, a weekend. And I see her husband. I don't see her. Where's your wife at? All right, next weekend. All right. So anyway. Anyway, we're looking at, I was going to say, I don't know why they have to work on their marriages. I have six kids, and they're staying together. I mean, it's like, that thing's in semen at this moment. All right. We're looking at the Luke chapter 10, verse 25 through 37. We've been looking at some of the questions that Jesus asked, and I think that this one will be very familiar to you. And I think maybe many of you, maybe most of you, will know this parable. Begins in verse 25. Jesus says, "And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tested him, saying, 'Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?' He said to him, 'What is written in the law? What is your reading of it?' And so he answered and said, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your strength, and with all of your mind, and your neighbor as yourself.' And he said to him, 'You have answered rightly. Do this, and you will live.' But he, wanting to justify himself, said to Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?' And Jesus answered and said, 'A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a certain priest came down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise a Levite, when he arrived at the place, came and looked, and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and he set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. And the next day when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said to him, 'Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you.' So which of these three do you think was the neighbor to him who fell among thieves?" And he said, "He who showed mercy on him." Then Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." This is a passage that obviously records a conversation between a lawyer and Jesus. Now, a lawyer here is a bit of a misnomer because oftentimes, and I think probably in every case that I'm aware of in the New Testament, when it says lawyer, he's talking about a person who was an expert in the law of Moses. So it might be better to say an Old Testament professor. So this Old Testament professor comes to Jesus and he says to him, "What do I need to do to go to heaven? What do I need to do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says to him, "Well, you're a lawyer. You've read the book. What does the book say?" The man says, "Well, the book says you ought to love the Lord your God with all of your soul, all of your strength, all of your mind, and then you're to love your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus says, "Well, that's right. That's what the book says. And you do that, you'll live." And in my mind, I see Jesus turning around, sort of walking away, sort of with a half smile. And the lawyer standing there thinking about that. And it seems simple enough till at least he begins to run that over in his mind. Because in one sense, he's like a kid who has asked, who has been given the option to write his own test. And then he's thinking, "Well, I might have just flunked my own test because the first part I get, but the second part is complicated, isn't it? Because is my neighbor the person who lives next to me, or is my neighbor the people who live in my town, or is my neighbor the people who live in the neighboring country? Just who is my neighbor? And so he asked Jesus that question. Well, who is my neighbor? I need clarification on that. And we do that, by the way, don't we? The Bible's pretty clear on something, and we say, well, it's not clear. The Bible says, thou shalt not lie, but what exactly does it mean to lie? I mean, what about a white lie? What about my taxes? Everybody, you know, everybody isn't completely honest on the taxes, or the Bible says this or that. I need a clarification of terms. And so this guy says, Jesus, you need to clarify the word neighbor for me. I'm unclear about that. And instead of answering that question, Jesus tells this story. He says, there's a guy, he's laying on the side of the road, went from Jerusalem down to Jericho. He's laying there, robbed, stripped naked. Everything's been taken from him, left half dead. Three guys come down the road. The first guy down the road is a priest. And what we know about the priests of that day is that one of the things they recited every morning was the great commandment. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind, strength, and your neighbor as yourself. If anybody knew the commandment, it would have been the priest. But the Bible says that when he passes or gets to the man, he passes by on the other side of the road, goes on his way. And you look at the priest and you say, why in the world would he have done something like that? And commentators throw out some theories. One theory was that perhaps the priest looked at the man and said, well, he looks dead to me. And the problem with being a priest is that you had to work in the temple. And when you worked in the temple, there were many ways that you could be ceremonially unclean. And if you were to touch a dead body, essentially you had a week of purification. You had to go through this hassle of being ceremonially purified so that you could then resume your position in the temple. And so perhaps he looks at the guy and says, you know, it's just my luck. I go over there and the guy's dead. And then I get to Jerusalem. I'm going to have to go through this hassle and it's not worth it. He's dead anyway. Somebody else, you know, is going to have to come along. I can't do anything for him. And so he passes on to the other side. Bible says that the Levite comes along. Levite was the associate pastor. The priest was the pastor. He comes by and he does the same thing. He passes by for his own reasons. On the other side, he goes on down the road. Then it says the Samaritan comes by, and it's well known that the Jews disliked the Samaritans intensely. That's probably one of the reasons this man would ask the question, because the Jews didn't like the Romans so much because the Romans occupied their territory. They really didn't like the Samaritans all that well. In fact, there's a passage in John chapter 8, verse 48, where Jesus is scrapping with the Pharisees or the religious teachers, and he makes them so angry, they're trying to find a way to insult him, and they're searching for an insult. And they say, you have a demon, and you're a Samaritan. I mean, that's the worst they could do. You're a demon-possessed Samaritan. That's as low as it could go. They didn't like the Samaritans, but Jesus, I think, pricking this guy, says, so this Samaritan comes by. Samaritan sees him laying there, goes over, bandages him, pours ointment on his wounds, puts him on his donkey, walks him to town, takes him to an innkeeper, says, take care of him, keep the bandages changed, be there for him, take care of him. I'm going to go travel, but when I get back, if it costs any more than I've already given you, I'll pay his hospital bill. Jesus looks at this man and says, so, who's the neighbor? And the guy says, well, he doesn't even use the word Samaritan. He says, well, that joker who showed mercy on him, I guess. The guy who showed mercy. And it's interesting that Jesus tells it like that, isn't it? Because, you know, when you're in your car, and you're driving down the road, it's 70 miles an hour, the air conditioner's on, radio's on, it's easy to think about who really is my neighbor. But when you're driving down the road, The car sputters. It stops. You're stranded. You left your cell phone at the office. You know what? It's not such a hard question to ask anymore, is it? I mean, your neighbor is anybody who will stop. If things are going well, it's easy to say, well, what exactly does it mean to be a good neighbor? What would it mean to be a neighbor? I mean, what exactly is my responsibility to my fellow man? That when you're on the side of the road, it's hot, you're broke down, it's a pretty easy question to answer. Anybody who will stop is a good neighbor. There's a little boy who was riding home with his parents, and the lesson in children's church had been on the Good Samaritan, and so he tells his father that they talked about the Good Samaritan, and the father wants to quiz him to see how good the teachers are doing, and he says, so, passage of the Good Samaritan, which you studied, what do you think the point is? A little boy said, well, I guess the point is that when I'm in trouble, you have to help me. And that's sort of a good reading of it, isn't it? I mean, the point is that if you are a good Samaritan, if you are loving your neighbor, you'll help the needs that you see that are in front of you. Now, to do that, there's a hook in there, because you have to see, you have to care, and ultimately, you and I have to sacrifice. It's interesting that this Samaritan sees this man laying there, and he sees him as a person in need. And we don't always do that. I mean, I think perhaps the priest and the Levite might have looked at him, if we can overinterpret this a little bit. I think they could have looked at him and said, listen, this guy really got what he deserved. This isn't a guy who's so much in need as a guy who makes a really terrible decision, and he's having to pay the price for this decision. I mean, everybody knew you don't travel the road from Jerusalem to Jericho alone with stuff. It was chock full of thieves, and you don't go out there by yourself like that, because if you do, you're just inviting somebody to rob you clean. And so it's possible that the priest and Levite might have looked at him and said, you know what? This is a guy who's got himself in a bad situation, but he brought it all on himself. And maybe that's all that they saw, somebody getting what they deserved. But I think the Samaritan looked at this guy and said, no, this is a man who may have got what he deserved, but he's also a man who needs some help, and I'm going to help him. See, we don't always see the same thing. I have a friend who has been a pastor for many years, and he's always been able to grow the churches that he pastored. Every church he ever went to grew because he really mastered the art of the bus ministry. Churches used to do the bus ministries more so in the 70s and 80s, but they sort of tapered out as transportation no longer became an issue and preventing people from getting to church in many ways. But he always could do a bus ministry. Everywhere he went, he could buy buses, send them out, and fill them with kids, and bring them in, and he could grow a church through busing people to church, mainly children. And I remember speaking to him once, and I said, so, you go to a town, how do you know which families will send their kids on the bus? Because people are very protective of their kids. How do you still get parents to put their kids on a bus with strangers and send them to a place that they've never been? How do you get them to entrust your children like that? Well, what's the secret? And he said, well, here's sort of the playbook. He said, you get in your car, you drive around town, and you're looking for houses with toys in the yard. He said, toys tell you two things. It tells you that there's kids, but it also tells you that you probably have very busy or very lazy parents, because if they weren't busy or lazy, they'd get the toys out of the yard. He said, so they have kids, and because they're very busy or very lazy, they are most likely to say, hey, you want my kids for 3 hours Sunday morning? You can have them. We're going to sleep in. If you want to babysit our kids for free, you can have those kids. He said, basically how you drum up a bus ministry. You think about that. I drive around town and I see toys in the yard, and there are toys in the yard. I have toys in the yard. He drives around town and sees some toys in the yard, and he says, oh, there's a prime candidate for our bus ministry. It all depends on what you see. You know, you either see a guy who smells like alcohol, or there are others who see a guy who smells like alcohol and they say, I wonder why he drinks. And I wonder why he drinks. I wonder if he's trying to forget some things that have been very painful in his past. There are some people who just see a guy with a drinking problem, but others sometimes are able to look past and say, I wonder if there's a lot of hurt and pain in his life that causes him to drink and he needs help. Sometimes you look at a person and say, you know, they just abuse pills. Look at them. They have no self-control. They need to get off those things. And that's true. They do need to get off those things. But some are able to look past the bruising that maybe they have brought to a great degree on themselves and to say, this is a person with perhaps a lot of hurt and pain in their life, and they're able to see past the bruising, and they're able to see that this is a person who needs help. Now, it's easy to jump on our youth, you know, in our culture. I'm 20 years removed from my teens. That's very sad. Everybody looks at you and says, you're young. I mean, come on, get over it. You'll be old soon enough. Enjoy 39. But I feel old. Starting to look old. My skin's starting to give way. And I'm starting to, it gets a little loose. I might have to start a chin fund, you know, up there. I'm 20 years removed from my youth. It's easy for people like me to say, you know, those kids are rotten, they're spoiled, they're terrible. But you know what? They're really good kids. You know, you look at our kids and it's easy to maybe look at some and say, you know, they're immature, they need more discipline, they need this, they need that. And maybe that's all true. But the kids today didn't get the childhood I got. You know, even when I grew up, we'd come home, we'd put our bags away, and I would go out and play till dark with the kids in our neighborhood. We'd build forts, we'd run, we'd be all over that place. My parents didn't know where I was at, but it was a safe, loving, open, free childhood. My kids aren't going to get that. I mean, I'm too protective. It's too dangerous out there. You look at kids today, and if you've been divorced, I don't want to beat you up. Don't leave here feeling beat up. You've already beat yourself up enough. Okay. But half of kids grow up in divorced families. 43% of kids grow up without a father in the home. And Huffington Post, which is not a conservative place by any means, they gave statistics a couple years ago. Do you know that kids who grow up in a divorced family are 7 times more likely to battle depression? 7 times more likely to battle depression with divorce. And half of our kids grown up in divorce. They don't have it easy. And you can look at a kid and say, well, they got this issue or that issue. And maybe you don't look, maybe you're not looking deep enough and seeing a lot of hurt in their lives and even in their parents' life who have had to make some difficult decisions that they would not have wanted to make. I mean, it's easy to look at a person and say, well, they're a hooker. You know, 50% of people in the sex trade were sexually abused as kids. 50%. You look at a person who isn't living up to the standard that the Bible sets, they need to leave that lifestyle, and we need to help them leave that lifestyle. But do you see a person who's brought it all on themselves, or are you able to maybe look past and see, this is a person who has had a very painful life in many, many cases. They're a person who needs our help. It all depends what you see. And the priest and the Levite, I don't think that they perhaps saw a man who was hurting and needed help. They saw a man who had made a foolish mistake and had brought some stuff on himself, and he needed to fix it himself. He just needed to not travel that road anymore. But the Samaritan saw somebody who needed some help. Not only do you have to see, though, you have to care. To care enough to go over there. And then not only do you have to care, you have to sacrifice. I mean, think about really the means that this Samaritan had to pour on this person. It cost him financially. I mean, he has to pay for his hospital bill. It cost him, as far as time goes, it was a hassle to help him and to stop. And I'm sure he had an appointment in Jerusalem. But he had to help. He had to get this guy set up, and then he had to go on his way. It was an inconvenience for him. So it cost him in time. It also cost him, really he had to pay in terms of protection, because again, it's a dangerous road. He had to keep this guy protected. He had to get him there. He had to provide health care for him. He had to provide all of these needs. So it was a sacrifice for him. Again, it's possible that the priest and Levi just looks at this situation and says, this is going to cost too much. Look at this guy. I don't have the money. I don't have the time. I don't have the inclination to help this guy. But this Samaritan did, and he was able to sacrificially reach out to him. And that's what it is always going to cost. If you see and care, it's always going to cost you something to be the neighbor you ought to be in terms of finances or time or in other ways of inconvenience. But I want you to see also the measure, because this is important. Sometimes we look at a passage like this and say, well, you know, I can't help everybody. So I'm going to have to choose who I'm going to help. You can't help everybody. I help some people. I'm a good neighbor, but nobody can help everybody. And that's true. And I don't think this passage is saying that you and I have to help everybody. What this passage is simply saying is you need to help the people in your path. Notice this guy didn't go to Jerusalem and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to build an organization called the Jericho Road Relief Fund, and I'm going to try to help everybody who has any problems on the Jericho Road. He didn't do that, and maybe the Lord might have called somebody to do that, but he didn't call this man to do this. What he simply did was he helped the person that he saw. And that's what God calls you and I to do. As we go through our day, the call on our lives is to be increasingly sensitive to the needs that we just see in front of us. Not to go out and try to help everybody in the neighborhood. Not to go out and mow every lawn in the neighborhood. Not to go out and spend every waking hour giving our time to every need that we see, helping every hand that's reached out. By the way, you notice, this is just in passing here. Notice he never does give this guy money. I mean, he helps this guy, but he helps him in a way that will actually help him. And sometimes people come to us and they want us to help them in a way that they deem fit, and they need all this kind of help. They need to go to rehab. They need to go to the hospital. They need to do this and that. But really all they want is money. This guy doesn't give them money. This guy gives the guy who owns the hotel money to help him. Essentially, he pays his hospital bill for him. He helps him in a way that he needs help. I mean, I think if this guy had gotten up and said, hey, you know what? If you'll just give me $20, I think I can stumble on into town. I don't think the guy would have given him the $20. But he says, I'll help you where you are, and I'll give you what you really do stand in need of. That's what God, I think, is calling for us to do, is to be increasingly sensitive to the needs that we see. I mean, again, he doesn't call you to mow every lawn in the neighborhood, but if you see your neighbor woman out there, you know, and she's 90 years old with a push mower, you might go help her. You see the need. Sometimes, you know, we're not called to give away all of our money, but if you're in line at the grocery store and somebody's $5 short, you see the need, you help the need. The point is that along the path that you walk, you're sensitive to the needs that are along that pathway. Let me talk just a minute about the motivation here, because oftentimes when we look at a passage like that, we say, you know, I really should be doing more. I mean, you're right, I haven't been as sensitive to the needs. And sometimes I see people with problems, and, and it's just going to cost too much, and it's an inconvenience, and I've got my own stuff to do, and I don't help, and I really do need to be helping more people. If you think like that, stop, don't do that. Because essentially what you're doing is you're motivating yourself through guilt, and guilt will get you through about Wednesday, and then you'll go back to what you were doing before. You can either be motivated by guilt, or you can be motivated by grace. And it's interesting to me in that context how Jesus, again, draws this picture of this scene on the road, and he gives everybody a name, the priest, the Levite, the Samaritan. The only person without the name is the guy on the road. And it seems to me that as Jesus is the master storyteller, he's saying, you're the guy on the road. You need to put yourself in this story, but you need to put yourself in this story as the guy on the road. I mean, that's the genius of the story, right? The guy asked the question, who is my neighbor? And Jesus, if he would have followed that thinking, he would have said, well, suppose you're going down the road and you see a need. That would be your neighbor, right? But instead, Jesus sort of turns it, and instead of answering the question, who is my neighbor, he answers the question, well, who would be a neighbor to you if you were in a bad situation? And that changes it. He doesn't answer the question that was actually asked. He flips the question sort of at the end. But I think he does that because he wants you to think of yourself on the road. And if you're a Christian today, you can't think of yourself laying there on the road, beaten, bruised, taken advantage of, without then thinking, and Jesus Christ is the ultimate Good Samaritan who found me in this situation, and he helped me. That's, I think, the motivation for living this passage, because that's us. If you're a Christian, you couldn't help yourself. You couldn't defend yourself. That's you. Your poor decisions had brought your life to a place where you had to cry out to God to help you. And the Samaritan came by, which was Jesus, and he did help you. And if you understand that that's you, then you can be motivated through your life starting now. It's got to have to grow because you've got a pattern in your life. I have patterns in my life, and sort of the seed has to take root and it has to begin to change us. But grace can be sown into your life where you can begin to be motivated through grace to help the other needs as you have been helped. See, the Christian dynamic is not to do unto others as you have, it's not to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's the golden rule, but that's not the Christian rule. The Christian rule is to do unto others as it has been done unto you, as Jesus has done to you, so you do for others. What is that? That is a grace-based way of living. If you're just sitting there saying, hey, I haven't been the kind of person that I ought to be, and I need to make a few changes in my life, listen, that's only going to get you so far. That's guilt. But if you can begin to say, I was the guy beaten, I was the guy beaten down, and Jesus came along and rescued me from my poor decisions and put me on the right path, and what he did for me, I'm going to begin to do to other people. As he sowed into my life, I'm going to begin to try to sow into others' lives. You do that, I think that you can find the motivation to actually live this passage out in your life. Jesus says, who's your neighbor? Who's your neighbor? It's the people in your path that have legitimate needs that you can meet as you journey through your day. To do that, you have to see it, you have to care, and there has to be a willingness in my life and in your life to sacrifice on their behalf. Will you stand with me?